Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, the second best exotic Marigold Hotel, the new comedy starring Maggie Smith and Judi Dench, in theaters everywhere Friday.
If you don't want anybody to see it, don't put it in an email, am I right? Also, healthcare goes back to court, and our series, The Transaction, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix GoTo Meeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. More at gotomeeting.com. And by Epson. Epson high-impact digital projectors are designed to enhance communication and inspire collaboration. Where there's business, there's Epson. And by Pure Insurance, specializing in insuring successful and responsible owners of fine-built homes. Learn more at pureinsurance.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here, everybody. It's Wednesday, the 4th of March today, and we begin with an item from the Marketplace desk of things you knew were going to happen. The Washington Post reports this afternoon the House Select Committee on Benghazi is going to issue a subpoena for relevant emails on the ClintonEmail.com server that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton used during her tenure. 5 will get you 10. There will be more about this topic, much, much more, as the electoral calendar progresses. But setting Clinton and the particulars of this case aside for just a second, if you could, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson went looking for some corporate parallels.
God, I hate my work email. The interface is just so clunky. I mean, I use it, but I don't like it. And I'm not alone. John Challenger is the CEO of Challenger Gray & Christmas, which conducts research on HR issues. He says when executives use a personal email, it's not necessarily nefarious.
There's not a clear line between work and personal life today. Not everybody keeps just a strict boundary between those two.
I think most people don't even think about it.
Jill Fish, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, says it's driven by convenience.
If anything, using your business email for personal reasons is more likely to be nefarious, kind of like using the company letterhead.
She says, like, if Clinton was using a government account to email her kid's school, throwing her title around. Still, many companies try to make employees use their email, thinking it's more reliable or secure. And in regulated industries, like for broker-dealers, it's a must, says Michael Rivera, head of Venable's Security Enforcement and Compliance Practice.
They have to have a system in place to capture every single email that comes in and out of the firm. This way, they have it all in one spot.
And can cough it up easily if the Securities and Exchange Commission comes knocking. So while Rivera says it's not illegal to use personal emails per se, it makes it nearly impossible for the company to retain those emails the way they're supposed to. And it just looks really dodgy. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The most senior job on the organizational chart at Toyota, short of CEO or chairman of the board, is executive vice president. Until today, no non-Japanese person had ever risen that high. Frenchman Didier Leroy now has that title, and it speaks directly, this hire does, to how well Toyota and Japan Inc. writ large is adapting to an increasingly global market. Marketplace's Scott Tong has spent some time reporting from Japan for us, so we put him on this story.
If you go to Tokyo and listen closely, you'll hear a faint gnashing of teeth about Galapagos syndrome, how Japanese products and organizations evolve only for the home island. Their cell phones don't work overseas. They still fax. Serious. You could say Toyota is global based on revenue or stock ownership, but economist Arthur Alexander, visiting professor at Georgetown, says not the company culture.
The upper management has been very traditional in how they look at employment and management.
They have to adapt or risk irrelevance. Remember Sharp, NEC?
They can see what's happening around them to these post-war Japanese dynamic companies falling on hard times.
One of Toyota's wake-up calls was a quality crisis where cars suddenly accelerated. The company blamed bad drivers and floor mats. A PR disaster blew up. Independent analyst Alan Baum faults an insular culture of hierarchy.
Because the decision-making process was still restricted to a smaller group of people in Japan, it simply took a while to get up the chain, and they weren't able to act as quickly as they would like.
He sees today's announcement of a non-Japanese executive as part of Toyota's effort to decentralize decision-making and adapt to a fast-changing world car market. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We started in the red on Wall Street today. We ended there as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This was a big day for healthcare. As you know, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a case known as King versus Burwell, a challenge to the subsidies included in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare to some. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein was in the Supreme Court chamber for arguments this morning. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Kai.
So what was it like in there? What was going on?
Well, apart from being penned in on one side of the room and craning my neck around 30-foot tall curtains and enormous marble columns just to glimpse a few of the justices, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. The big takeaway here is that all the justices seem to really get it, Kai. While they spent 84 minutes debating legal theory, the most vocal justices on the left and the right spoke to the potential real-world impact here. We're talking about millions of Americans potentially losing their insurance. Even Justices Alito and Scalia, in a way, offered sorts of contingency plans. Scalia talked about Congress coming up with a solution if these subsidies go away. Alito mentioned that the subsidies wouldn't have to be eliminated immediately, potentially buying Congress some time.
That does sort of smack of hoping there's a plan B. What are businesses doing, businesses that would be affected by this ruling if it goes against them? What are they planning for?
Well, look, it's a reasonable question. One thing you need to know here is that businesses were a little slow to this, Kai. I mean, they really didn't understand. The initial thought was it is inconceivable to think that this case, which is in some ways basically about a typo, it was going to go to the Supreme Court. And now here it is in the Supreme Court. And so when that momentum really started to build and the healthcare industry really understood this is going somewhere, they decided, okay, we've got to get on board. They filed all these amicus briefs in favor of the federal government supporting the Affordable Care Act. And so that's a long way of saying the industry doesn't really have much up its sleeve right now. But one thing is for sure, insurers are thinking about whether they can file sort of two premium rates right now, a cheaper one in a world with the subsidies, a more expensive one if those subsidies go away. And then, in terms of the doctors and the hospitals, one source told me today that nobody has much faith in Congress coming up with a solution. So the big play for them is really to hit the lobbying hard at the state level and try and get state politicians to create a state exchange, which would make this problem go away overnight.
What about the other people involved in finding a contingency? That is consumers. I mean, what are consumers going to do?
Right. Well, one 50-something couple from Mississippi that I spoke to after the hearing this morning said their contingency plan is to pray. They laughed about it, but they said they really don't know what to do right now. They do know if their subsidy goes away, it's going to probably mean picking a different plan with lower monthly costs, but much higher deductible. So ultimately, a lot more out-of-pocket exposure than what they have. And really, you know, the consumers have to put their faith in the Supreme Court, Congress, and state and local political leaders, Kai.
Dan Gorenstein, our healthcare correspondent in the Supreme Court for the arguments this morning. Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kai.
You get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You go out to tend the herd or work on the equipment or to check the grain elevator. You do it in good weather or in bad. You grab a quick bite to eat at lunch, then you work till sundown, and oftentimes you still can't make a living. That's the reality for a lot of farmers in this country today. Farming has been tough for generations, but it's arguably harder now than it's ever been, and a lot of small farmers out there can't get by without having a second job. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer went out to Iowa to learn more.
The Lilienthal farm is tucked into a corner of eastern Iowa, about a half hour's drive from the mighty Mississippi and Illinois border. It's 400 acres of flat, fertile farmland. The farm's been in the family for about 150 years. I pull up to a trim white farmhouse. The Lilienthals are gracious and hardy, so they agree to give me a quick tour of the farm. Even though it's 7 degrees outside, Dale Lilienthal is the family patriarch. He points to a shed.
Dad built this machine shed, so he said, I'm going to build this so the doors are high enough and wide enough, and now they're not high enough or wide enough.
That's because the equipment Dale's son uses today dwarfs his father's. Bob Lilienthal is in the process of taking over the family farm. He rents the farmland and hundreds more acres around it. He had to build a shed the size of a warehouse for his machines, like this monster tractor. Bob Lilienthal built an immense new hog barn, too. Bob raises more than 1,000 pigs at a time. His father used to have a couple hundred. Still, even though everything is bigger and better, Bob Lilienthal struggles to match his father's standard of living, even though he has a side business. I've come here to find out why. But first, we have to get warm. We hustle into the cozy farmhouse kitchen. On the table, cookies and hot chocolate. This was going to be a good interview. I get things going with this question for the young farmers at the table.
Do you ever think to yourself, my goodness, you could just farm in the old days, and now it's like you have to have all these separate things?
Bob Lilienthal's business partner, Chad Rocco, pipes up.
The bar has been raised.
Rocco says it costs more to farm now. Even after you factor in inflation, everything is more expensive. Fertilizer, equipment, and the prices the Lilienthals get for their corn, soybeans, and livestock haven't kept up. Rocco says their profit margins are thinner than Dale Lilienthal's were. So they have to farm more land, raise more pigs, and do lots of other stuff.
It's more like what don't we do? There might be 8 or 10 basically different businesses.
They even have a foam insulation business, totally unrelated to the farm. They do some contract farming, plowing other people's fields, raising pigs for the giant Cargill Corporation. They're paid to raise Cargill pigs in their barn. But Bob Lilienthal says big corporations are one reason it's hard to be a small farmer now.
There's all these big companies, Cargill, Tyson, they all own sows, they all own pigs, and they own the packing plant, so they're very hard to compete against.
There were no Cargills or Tysons when Bob's father, Dale Lilienthal, was farming. And here's another thing. The price of farmland has skyrocketed. Dale Lilienthal remembers when he bought a chunk of land back in 1962.
Like when we first got married, I bought ground for $400 an acre. Now that same ground is worth, what, $10,000, $12,000.
The farm across from the Lilienthals sold for $12,000 an acre a few years ago. All this stuff, the soaring land prices, rising costs, competition, it's happening across the country. The Lilienthal situation is typical. Paul Lasley teaches sociology at Iowa State University and studies farm communities. He says 50 to 60% of farmers in the U.S. have some kind of second job off the farm.
Part-time farming is pervasive, and it appears to me to be permanent. And I think there'll even be more reliance on off-farm income.
Maybe they drive a school bus or sell insulation like Bob Lilienthal. Back at his kitchen table, Dale Lilienthal can only shake his head and marvel at the innovation of today's farmers.
You got to be a lot sharper to be a farmer now than when I started. When I started, if you had were strong and, you know, did things on time, you were successful. These guys got to be very good business people now.
So why do they do it? Well, that's one thing that hasn't changed. They feel the pull of the land like previous generations did. They like to watch things grow, be their own boss, even if that means working harder to stay in place. In Durant, Iowa, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Nancy took her camera out to Iowa with her. We've got pictures from the Lilienthal family farm at marketplace.org. Coming up.
To this day, when I walk past my range, I have to smile at myself.
Our series, The Transaction, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off more than 0.5% today. That's 106 points, ended at 18,096, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ hiked 0.25%, 12 points, closed at 49.67. The S&P 500 stepped up 0.4%, 9 points, finished at 2,098. Healthcare looked a little pinker in the cheeks as investors bet the U.S. Supreme Court will not overturn the Affordable Care Act. HCA Holdings rose 5.8%. Tenet Healthcare hiked nearly 6.2% today. Restaurant and packaged food company Bob Evans Farms released disappointing numbers and thus fell 22%. Target off 0.3% today on the back of news late yesterday that will eliminate several thousand jobs both here and in India. Abercrombie & Fitch unzipped nearly 15.5% on news its quarterly profit fell by 1/3. Apparently, we don't like logos on our clothes anymore. I don't know what that's about. But you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price. The markets may be uncertain, but institutions, advisors, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price's disciplined investment approach to help reach their long-term investment goals. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. And by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions designed to help organizations of all types and sizes reduce labor costs, improve workforce productivity, and minimize compliance risk. Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by the Financial Times, providing in-depth global comment and analysis on the latest international business, economic, and political news. The Financial Times. Prepare to read beyond the expected. Have something to say about one of our stories or want to suggest your own? Find us on Twitter at Marketplace or join us on Facebook to interact with producers, reporters, and the hosts of Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for January. The Labor Department issues its revised productivity and cost report for the fourth quarter. And Country Music Hall of Famer Patsy Cline died in a plane crash 52 years ago on March 5, 1963. She was 30. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. By the time a business decides to pull the plug, almost nobody's surprised. Handwriting has been on the wall, as it were. But it does very much depend on what kind of business we are talking about. Sweetbriar College near Lynchburg, Virginia, has been around for 114 years, but the school announced yesterday this academic session will be its last. It's been losing students and money for years, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
These are tough times for liberal arts colleges.
Fewer and fewer students want what they sell.
Victor Farrell is the former president of Beloit College and the author of Liberal Arts at the Brink. Gone are the days, he says, when kids and their parents are willing to pay for languid afternoon classes spent debating philosophy on a leafy quad. Today, says Farrell,
education is very focused on a good job.
In a recent survey of college freshmen, more students said they chose to go to college to get a better job than to get a general education. Sweetbriar had other headwinds. It's rural, so there are fewer opportunities for socializing and internships. And it's all women. Marilyn Hammond is the interim president of the Women's College Coalition.
Getting women to consider a women's college at the beginning of their search is challenging.
Enrollment at Sweetbriar has been falling. So is the percentage of tuition and fees its students pay. The college has an endowment of around $85 million, which helps cover operating expenses. But it's not enough.
Sweetbriar has been struggling against financial obstacles for several decades.
Dr. Jimmy Jones is the college president.
If there were a magic wand, we would have found it. There's not one.
Victor Farrell, the former Beloit president, thinks the future of higher ed is a future with fewer true liberal arts colleges. Most, he thinks, won't go the way of Sweetbriar. They'll instead become more career-focused.
They'll teach you how to do this and how to do that.
And all those leafy quads will have more room for Frisbee. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
More from Dr. Jones, the president of Sweetbriar, when he talks to our David Gura on the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow. The New York Times store launched a bit more than 15 years ago, mostly as a place to buy reprints of articles from the paper. Now, though, you can get anything from personalized oak whiskey barrels to a rotating globe of Jupiter, should you so desire. The site just did a redesign, which does prompt one to wonder how media companies choose the goods they sell. Marketplace's Sally Herships went shopping for you-know-what to find out.
It turns out there's a reason the public radio tote bag is so popular. Barbara Sopato picks products for the NPR store.
When I started, I thought we're never going to sell a tote bag or a mug because everyone that's involved in public broadcasting has those things from a pledge drive somewhere in their life. But those are huge sellers for us.
Because she says NPR shoppers are eco-conscious. They're also curious, tend to have pets, enjoy cooking and gardening. Margaret Duffy is the director of the Institute for Advertising Ethics at the Missouri School of Journalism. She says media outlets are also trying to attract advertisers.
One of the things that they would clearly like to tell their advertisers is that they have a demographic that is willing and able to spend significantly on products and services.
Say, like an antique brass clock on the New York Times site for $6,500.
Media outlets are brands. The New York Times is as much a brand as Pepsi, Coke, and McDonald's.
Alan Adamson is with Landor, the branding company. He says just like any other retailer, a media store has to know what its customers want.
For the New York Times, you'd want to sell upscale, powerfully intellectual brand items.
But most media stores are just promoting their brands. Marissa Gluck is with Huge, a branding agency.
Their primary revenue stream is advertising. It's not really selling sweatshirts for $50 a pop.
And in case you're wondering, ethics professor Margaret Duffy says it's fine for news outlets to sell goods. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We started a new series a month or so ago, built on a pretty basic premise. How the simple act of buying something, a good old-fashioned exchange of goods and services, can lead to something unexpected, something that changed the way you think about things or maybe even changed your life. We're calling it The Transaction, and today we've got one from listener Vivian Simonson-Jupp of Henderson, Nevada.
This is a story about my own little Christmas miracle. It was December of 2010, and I was really looking forward to spending the first Christmas in 6 years at home here in the U.S. with my two daughters. For the previous 6 years, I had been traveling to Costa Rica, where my mother lived, to spend time with her and give respite to her caregivers. This year, however, I was going to get to spend Christmas at home. On the night of December 22nd, I was baking my last batch of empanadas when my 21-year-old oven just quit. It died. The following morning, I found myself at my local Sears store, as soon as the doors opened, looking at ranges. And I found one that I liked, which really means one that, you know, I could afford. Unfortunately, it was not in stock and it wasn't available for delivery. I decided on another model, which was considerably more than I had intended to spend, but the salesman reassured me that that particular oven could be delivered on Christmas Eve. And he explained to me that I should expect a call that evening on the night of the 23rd, advising me of delivery time. I was especially pleased because both my daughters were home and we had plans for dinner with some old friends and their four children. So later that evening, when I got the robocall from Sears advising me that my oven would be delivered between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m., I was devastated. This, of course, meant that I wouldn't be able to roast the turkey that was defrosting in my refrigerator in time for Christmas Eve dinner. I literally sat down and cried. I was so upset. the next morning, now it's the 24th of December, resigned to having, you know, pizza and a salad for Christmas Eve dinner, I went with my oldest daughter to go do some shopping. At about 10:30, I got a phone call, and it was my younger daughter. She had stayed home to sleep in, and she was so excited. I couldn't understand what she was saying on the phone. I asked her to settle down, and she said, "Mom, the doorbell rang, and I opened the door, and there's a gentleman standing there, and he says to me, 'I'm from Sears, and we have your oven.'" I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, my God. And, she, you know, of course, I was pleased. But she says, "Mom, the name tag on his shirt, his name is Jesus, Jesus. Mom, Jesus brought you your Christmas Eve oven." Well, of course, I was so blown away. And we hurried home and put the turkey in the oven and had dinner in the nick of time, a great dinner, and went to Christmas Eve Mass. And it was a Christmas that I will always remember. To this day, when I walk past my range, I have to smile at myself and think about, you know, the oven that Jesus brought on Christmas Eve and how truly fortunate I am.
We know you've got a story too. Come on, you know you do. Tell us. Go to marketplace.org. Maybe we'll get it on the radio. This final note on the way out today, which sadly passes for fun when you cover business and the economy. The Federal Reserve released the transcripts of its 2009 meetings and conference calls today, all 1,648 pages of them. A quick word search this morning reveals the following. In those pages, there are 237 mentions of the word recession, 242 mentions of interest rates, and for what it's worth, 298 instances where laughter is noted in the transcript. To be fair, sometimes Ben Bernanke and the gang, they were kind of funny. Also, for what it's worth, in the March 2009 meeting, and this is actually substantive, so listen up, Janet Yellen, then the head of the San Francisco Fed, said the economy was so lousy that it needed so much help that the federal funds rate, the Fed's main interest rate, ought to have been at negative 6%. Think about that for just a second.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, a proud Marketplace sponsor for 7 years, committed to helping small businesses meet their goals with email and online marketing. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Allianz, serving more than 83 million customers worldwide and providing retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the United States. AllianzUSA.com. And by RingCentral, the cloud communication system that integrates with CRM, sales and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. More at ringcentral.com.
Come on, negative 6% on the federal funds rate? That's crazy, right? Today, the Dow off more than 0.5%, 106 points. The NASDAQ dropped 0.25%, that's about 12 points. The S&P 500 fell 0.4%, that is 9 points. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.